Et Naim, Nikki Yasam Hilo, Nikki Machuptamaidu. Hello, everyone. My name is Hilo, and I'm Machuptamaidu. We acknowledge and are mindful that Chico State stands on lands that were originally occupied by the first people of this area, the Machupta, and we recognize their distinctive spiritual relationship with this land and the waters that run through campus. We are humbled that our campus resides upon sacred lands that have sustained the Machupta people for centuries and continue to do so today.
Good morning. Thank you to everyone here joining us today. Awesome to see people on our Zoom and some faces and videos off. So super excited. So today's a very special workshop. We are actually co-hosting our EOP workshop today along with our Josh and I's podcast, First Generation, One of Many. So it's being recorded. Hopefully that's okay with everybody. And so also we're going to be posting it, or Josh will be posting it, so we can refer back to it and be able to listen to it later on as well. So my name is Teresa Hernandez. I am an admission specialist and advisor with the EOP program here. Excited to be with you all today. And so our workshop today, our Zoom webinar, is called A Commitment to Anti-Racism from 1968 to Today. So it's my pleasure to introduce our other co-host for today's webinar, and that's Joshua Whittinghill. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Teresa. Yes, this is awesome, right? Our first live podcast.
And yes, I'm excited.
It's been at least, 2 weeks since we've recorded one, so it is great to be doing it again. I think I say that every time we get to record. It seems like we have a break, but it is wonderful to be here with our colleagues and guests from EOP. And then all of you that have joined, thank you for being here. This is great. We were joking beforehand, maybe there'll be two people and we'll just have an intimate discussion, but then it bursted up to 20. So that's fantastic to see. So did you want to share the mission of the podcast?
Let's see. Yes, I'll pull it up. I just got put on the spot, everybody.
Uh-oh.
That's fine. All right. So quickly, before we introduce the rest of our team and get started, again, we're First Generation, One of Many, and our mission is to create an archive of discussions with and about first generation student experiences in and out of the classroom. We hope to continue raising awareness and understanding, provide voice for students and the alum, as well as present resources for faculty, staff, and students working for and collaborating with first generation students. So that's our podcast's mission. And it aligns really well with EOP's mission, which we're going to talk to you a little bit more about today.
Yeah, and today we're going to have some discussion of where EOP was, where it began, where it's gone over the years, what's happening now, and what are some of our hopes as we look forward to moving forward as individuals and as a program. But with tradition, we like to have a couple of quotes. So we have, I have two quotes to share today. One of them is from Thurgood Marshall, and it really speaks to the discussion of anti-racism and what's happening around the country these days, and has been for decades and centuries, as we know. He says, "I wish I could say that racism and prejudice were only distant memories. We must dissent from the indifference. We must dissent from the apathy. We must dissent from the fear, the hatred, and the mistrust. We must dissent because America can do better, because America has no choice but to do better." And that's from Thurgood Marshall. And then the second one comes from a professor, author, and historian, Erica Lee. And Alvina, you may be familiar with her. She is also an alum of UC Berkeley. And in an interview from 2020, when asked about what stereotypes and racism mean for Asian Americans, she explains that the rhetoric around immigration and disease feeds and then it justifies existing stereotypes and racism around immigrants, and then leads to discriminatory public health policies and disproportionately impact specific immigrant groups and minority groups. So these are all important parts of our discussion for today, and we couldn't do it, just me and Teresa. Those would probably be extremely long, tedious, boring episodes. So to help us, we bring in guests, and we have three amazing guests today. And first we have Victoria Bass. She is the Associate Director of EOP. She was born and raised in Northern California. She received her BA in Social Sciences with an emphasis in History from Sonoma State University, and continued on to receive a teaching credential from CSU Chico. She has always had a passion for education and greets every day looking forward to helping students in any way she can. Welcome, Vicky. Got to unmute yourself, Vicky. Go ahead. Welcome.
Oh, hi, everybody. Am I talking right now?
Or we're Nope. Yeah, thanks for being here, Vicky. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. And our next guest is Mr. Tia Billy Lowe. Billy is the coordinator for our first year experience program in EOP. He also goes by Billy, like you've heard me say many of times. And Billy, can you pronounce your first name for us? Because I know I don't do a good job with Hmong when I try.
Oh, you're pretty good. Tia.
Thank you.
Tia. So you, if you say it's, that's part of it's and here. Tia. Hello, everyone.
So Tia Lowe, also known as Billy. He also is an alum of Sonoma State University and joined EOP in the spring of 2018. And he's an avid bug collector. Is that right?
That is not right. And we like to play tricks on each other. So I may have supplied him with that information, but hello, everyone.
But you even supplied me with, is that right, is the question. So that's why I asked it.
I know. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here.
Yep. Thanks for being here, Billy, too. Now, our third guest is Alvina Vu, also known as Alvina Vu. She is an academic advisor and admissions specialist who works closely with our EOP transfer students. She's been at Chico State for a little more than a year. She was born and raised in Sacramento. She earned her bachelor's degree in sociology from UC Berkeley and her master's in counseling, specializing in career counseling from Sacramento State. She's deeply passionate about working with first-generation students and loves helping students to achieve their goals. Welcome, Alvina.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to share this space with you all. And I did want to share that the song that we were listening to at the beginning, it's called Gutuna'e, and it's by Hu Chi Yang, and he's a Hmong artist.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, now we're going to kick it off with Vicky sharing a little bit of current time, and then also getting us into the history of EOP a little bit.
Okay, thank you, Josh. So before we get started, everyone, it's important for us to recognize this past year, our nation has seen an alarming surge in anti-Asian attacks and rhetoric. Since the beginning of this pandemic, the Asian Pacific Islander Desi American communities have been blamed for the COVID-19 virus, which has been referred to in racist terms such as the China virus and Kung Flu. Here at EOP, we stand in solidarity with our APIDA communities in condemning any and all acts of hate, intolerance, and discrimination. We seek to foster a campus climate and culture that is welcoming to all APIDA students, faculty, staff, community members, and alumni. And we ask that you join us in taking action to support our APIDA communities. And thank you, Alvina, for getting us that statement together. It's important to acknowledge these things as we are talking about Kendi's book and as we are talking and we get together in these spaces together to be able to acknowledge what's going on in the world today. So let's start with our talk and why we're here. So the Education Opportunity Program, our mission from the core in the beginning has been to provide access and support services to first generation college students who have experienced economic, educational, and or environmental barriers, but display the potential to succeed in post-secondary education and to assist the university in the matriculation and retention and graduation of EOP students. So when Laura Nice, who is the chair of the Book and Common Committee, we had these discussions about how EOP can facilitate a Book in Common, and it seemed like a perfect fit. So we know in How to Be an Anti-Racist, Kendi explains how people can actively become anti-racist. So if you're not anti-racist, you're racist, and ways to improve our ideas, philosophies, conversations, policies about racism, we have to have the conversations, which is difficult, which is taxing, frustrating, but it's also necessary. So in having a conversation about how to create an anti-racist culture and spaces on a university campus, it's important to look at the history of Chico State and what the institution has done and hasn't done to contribute to this culture. The approval to start a pilot of the Education Opportunity Program in the fall of 1968 was a critical step in creating an anti-racist space at this university. Now let's take a look at how we got here.
During the 60s, with issues of the Vietnam War, civil rights, recognizing the racism and the barriers that were preventing communities of color.
Hope it doesn't restart by itself again.
During the 60s, with issues of the Vietnam War, civil rights, recognizing the racism and the barriers that were preventing communities of color from being able to move forward. And education was seen as a critical civil right that was being denied. As students, we were leading the vanguard of social change throughout the world and seeing the role that students played in fighting the war in Vietnam, fighting for civil rights, fighting for empowerment of communities, not just in the US, but throughout the world, connecting with students from Europe, from Asia, from South America. We were a movement that was creating revolution.
At that point, EOP was not a statewide program. So we went to Sacramento and began to lobby for EOP. Reverend Diamond Lee, especially Willie Brown from San Francisco, and he was Speaker of the House at the time, so he pushed for it.
There was a simultaneous effort to try to make things right. There were protests all over the CSU. Strong protest. We marched on Broadway in San Diego, protesting, stopping traffic. We did a sit-in at the president's office. We were kicked out. San Francisco State maintained that protest on campus for months until they had to have riot police come and break it up. In Sacramento, we had a lot of conservative people. And so there was a lot of resistance to helping programs like an educational opportunity program. There was an effort to try to find the most conservative senator in Sacramento to sponsor a bill. And it was Senator Harmer, and he sponsored Senate Bill 1072.
Okay, thank you, Josh. And I always love history, being able to determine where we're at and where we're going from here. And specifically, it's important to realize that it was on May 23rd, 1968, that the Faculty Senate here at Chico approved the Education Opportunity Program for the next year. So Chico State was one of two campuses approved to start a pilot program. And the pilot program started before the legislation was actually implemented. And this program led the way for all the other CSU campuses to implement an EOP program. And again, when we look at what we do and how we can continue this culture of creating anti-racist spaces on campus to promote access to education, which is what the CSUs are designed to do, it starts with programs like EOP. So let's hear a little bit about where we're currently at. Is that right, Josh? Where we're going next?
Yes, thank you. And that video is, if you haven't been exposed to or learned much about EOP along the way, it's a great introduction to where we've come from. And for me, I know it's a great reminder. You know, even though I see it many different times, it's always a good reflection to remember what was happening then and how it connects to what's happening still today. And you can see when we started in that pilot year of 1968, there were 74 students that represented diverse backgrounds, from African-American students, American Indian students, Mexican-American and white students in that group of 74. Through the years, we've grown to up to about 1,200 at some of our largest cohorts. And then currently we're around 1,028. It's just a guess from the report I ran, but it is around that number. When the semester started, we had that number. And so we wanted to share, where are our students around campus? We're looking at just sort of their academic side of it. And so you can see the different ethnicities and races that students select when they apply to college. We pull those and we can see there, we have the eight different categories. And then across campus, you can see a fairly balanced distribution for a lot, but then you see in BSS, a lot of our students go to BSS. Whether they start there or not, that's where many of them end up at. So I'll leave it up for a second if you just want to see that there. And Teresa, we see where our students are currently around campus, but what are they doing as far as classes and how are they doing?
Hi, yeah, great question. So we do have a data point on that. So when we look at our EOP students and what their majors fall specifically, what colleges they're in, and how many units they take in those colleges. So we have a bar graph that kind of that represents that. So majority of our EOP students are in the College of HFA, as well as business. So that's where majority of our students fall. And so you can look at our most popular majors and where a lot of our EOP student population will fall under and kind of get an idea as to the type of classes they're taking, the amount of units they're taking due to their major, as well as the next one. So we're also taking a look at the GPA of our students. So with EOP, one of our pillars is supporting our students in academics and making sure that they have access to their paraprofessionals, their advisors as well, if they have any questions, particularly, especially with when it comes to what classes to take and those routes and supporting them as well, making sure they have those resources from their transition from high school to college. And so our students do well. When it comes to school, they do really well. As you can look on the bar graph, their GPAs are fairly high, definitely above between the 2.0 and 2.9 range. We have quite a few students. Majority of them are above the 2.5. So, and then the rest of our student population will fall between the 3.0 and the 4.0 population. So definitely our students benefit a lot from the academic support they have, not only from EOP, but the different programs and research programs they're involved in around campus. Our students are also generally involved in multiple different support programs, not just EOP. And so they're doing really well when it comes to their academics at Chico State. All right. And so next, we are going to hear from our very own Billy Lowe.
Thank you for that. Not nervous at all for this moment. My name is Billy Lowe. I'm the first year experience coordinator. So a little bit about our first year experience program. It's designed to help EOP freshmen transition into college life. I say college life because there's more to the college experience than courses and going to your classes and doing well. So we do that by providing specialized advising services, educational workshops, and creating strategic social activities. And if I can elaborate on that a bit, here at Chico State, we'll utilize the help of paraprofessional advisors. We call them parapros. It's not always the requirement, but they usually are upperclassmen, EOP students, who've experienced a few years here in terms of being experts. We'll also take them through student staff training as well to help hone in on those skills. But they'll meet with our first year EOP students about every 2 weeks or so. So about twice in a month, just to check in, see how students are doing, answer questions, provide reminders, and just make sure that they're supported throughout their first year here at Chico State. Another resource that we'll offer is the course link. That's a collection of classes that our first year EOP students will take. That's only offered to the first year students. And in the fall semester, have it on the slide here. Introduction to University Life or University 101, Small Group Communications, CMSC 132. They'll take that in the fall semester along with the other courses that they're taking to fill out their semester, as well in the spring semester, MCGS 155, which is Introduction to Multicultural and Gender Studies, and Freshman Composition, which is the English 130. So these are courses that they'll be able to take alongside of other first year students. Some of the educational and social programs that I wanted to highlight are EOP and study skills workshops put on by our office and the Student Learning Center. So some of those workshops, if I can just highlight a few, I'll cover time management, registration, note-taking, concentration, and imposter syndrome, just to name a few. As well, if I could highlight two social programs that we'll put on, one in the fall, the end of the year culminating activity that we'll put on for the first year students, as well the EOP graduation ceremony. Use my words, EOP graduation ceremony that we'll put on in the spring semester. We'll invite our first year students to participate in that, and just it's a nice culminating activity that we'll put on for the program that we invite our first year students to participate in as well. That's it from me. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you, Billy. As Billy mentioned, he does a lot for our first year students on our team. So thank you, Billy, for everything that you do and for sharing some of your hard work with all of us today. And apart for our first year program, we also have Alvina Vu, who's going to be talking a little bit more on the work within EOP and sharing some information with us as well. So thanks, Alvina.
All right. So I'm going to be talking about just things that EOP can do and things that we all can do to kind of strengthen our anti-racist policies. Before I start, I wanted to introduce this concept of the pyramid of success, student success, by Dr. Jay Lukewood, who is a professor of education and the associate vice president for faculty diversity and inclusion at San Diego State. So he makes the case that whenever we talk about professional development in a higher ed setting, everyone wants to walk away with a one-page cliff notes or like a short 10-bullet point sheet of practices or strategies on how to work with specific populations. And Dr. Wood says that jumping to these strategies and practices without first addressing the base, which is our perception of how we view ourselves and how we view our students, then we could possibly be doing more harm than good. And we can talk about practices and it's important, but before we can talk about practices, we have to talk about perception. Because perception influences how we relate with one another, which is the second box. And then relationships influence how we engage within our effective teaching practices, our advising, our counseling techniques, or other support practices. And if we do these things in this order and we're mindful, it would ultimately lead to student success. Next slide. So one thing that our program and other programs, departments, or professionals can do to strengthen their anti-racist policies, and I hope this comes at no surprise, is to learn about racial microaggressions, racial battle fatigue, implicit bias, race lighting, and intersectionality. We all have work to do. You may know a lot and work really well with a certain population, but that doesn't mean that you're good in other areas and other communities. And it's dangerous to have this mindset that we've arrived and that we've reached a level where we don't need to learn anymore. Because of that, I think it's important that we continue to engage in intensive, ongoing, equity-based professional learning. And I'll be the first to admit that all of us at EOP, we still have a lot of work to do and a lot of internal work to do. Next slide. So my background is in counseling. And so as we look at data and we analyze the complexities of systems, I always come back to the personal and the individual interactions that we have. I always think about the humanistic aspect of what we do. And I hope that all of our work is grounded in student-centered framework. And with that, I want to talk about how we can use empathy as a tool for equity work. But first I want to show this animated video by Dr. Brené Brown, about empathy. And I like this video a lot because it shows us that empathy allows us to authentically connect with our students if we're brave enough to get in touch with our own fragility. Could someone play the video?
So what is empathy and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time, because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
Oh, can we go to the next slide, please? So as in the video, empathy and sympathy are different, right? They're both important in our relationships, but they are different. And we can think of empathy as understanding, and you can feel what someone is going through without having experienced it yourself. And the scope of empathy allows us to experience empathy in both positive and negative experiences that our students share with us. However, sympathy only shows up when there are negative experiences and there's an uneven power dynamic present. And for this reason, I encourage all of us to practice empathy with our students, because empathy allows us to remove ourselves from our roles and to take on the perspective of our diverse students. And it allows us to feel with our students and helps us to offer culturally relevant services. And when you have empathy, it allows you to see the structural barriers that your students may be facing. And it allows you to see the obstacles that your students face when they leave the classroom and when they leave campus. Next slide, please. We should use empathy as a tool to inform how we design and deliver our programs, and also how we define student success. This is why empathy matters. We should move away from an approach to student success based on quantification and objectification of our students. Instead, our efforts towards student success can only be realized when all students, in particular those historically marginalized in higher education, share in the ownership and participation in the institution. I think that a lot of our efforts to support our students stop when we learn that maybe our students are doing well academically. They're getting passing grades and we kind of stop. And I think that what I think about whether retention rates and graduation rates are truly indicative of student success or a conformance to the dominant culture in higher education. And don't get me wrong, I think that retention and graduation are important, especially when there's disparities. However, retention and graduation rates, do they really show us that our students experience harmful practices? And do our marginalized students feel included, important, and desired? Next slide. Finally, I want to share this quote because we all take part in the system, which is Chico State. And the quote is, every system is perfectly designed to achieve the results that it gets. And it's by Dr. William Edward Deming. And it speaks to the fact that as an institution, if we are producing racist educational outcomes, the responsibility falls back onto us. And we should reframe these outcomes as an indication of institutional underperformance rather than the student's underperformance. And I challenge all of us to critically reflect on the role and responsibilities, our roles and responsibilities on this campus, and how it attributes to outcome disparities. And I will give it back to the host.
Well, thank you, Alvina. Those are great discussion points. There's a lot to unpack there in those slides. And yesterday there was a workshop I was able to present for about 45 of our first year students came into, and it was about social emotional learning. And so they really shared and talked about how they were feeling, and a lot more of their success, like you're saying, was not necessarily grade based for them, but their growth as individuals was important. And then the intersectionality showed up on our list there of something to learn, understand, but also more of the interconnectedness that some of our experiences have, because I know for me, as much as I do, I'm never going to be able to understand the journey that other people take, but I can understand the end result, the feeling that might come with it, or the outcome, or the consequences, or the benefits. I can understand those parts, but the journey part is individual for everyone and very nuanced and extremely meaningful, because they add stories to all those data points. If you just look at data points, they don't mean anything, right? It's just numbers and crunching. And so we have to have the life that goes with those things. So thank you for all of that. Now, at the end of our episodes, we always have some recommendations. So we put these together prior to, so I'll share these, and they will be obviously on the recording. They'll be in the PowerPoint, and I'm sure all of these will get to you in some form. And so our first one is a website, Stop AAPI Hate. It's a wonderful resource for up to date what's happening. They have a number of reports currently, if you haven't seen this website already, of some of the instances and discussions around what is being done in different communities, and then different resources of how you can interact and be an agent in stopping AAPI hate. The second one is Race Lighting, a prevalent version of gaslighting facing people of color. So it's an article that talks about that. The Harvard Implicit Biases, if you haven't seen that website already, there's about 12 different surveys you can take. And they're based on different things from race, sexual orientation, gender. And so you can then see if you have kind of like where your implicit biases may lie by answering those surveys. And then the last site is Showing Up for Racial Justice. And they have a number of different categories that look at from discussion to time management, but looking at how do those areas succeed and how do they fail when you're looking at social justice and anti-racist policies and practices. And that's a great website there as well. And then now we've come to our question and discussion or question and answer time. If you have some that you'd like to ask, go ahead and unmute. If you'd like, or raise your hand, we can call on you. And there was one question earlier, right, Teresa, in there about is EOP a California program only, but there are other EOPs and other states have EOP, but ours is funded by the Chancellor's office and taxpayer dollars, of course. Other states do have EOP though as well. So we'll open it up then for anyone. We are monitoring the chat if you don't want to ask it.
Josh, if I could add something, I think it's important for us to realize that as we are having this conversation about anti-racism and the spaces, and spaces specifically here for Chico State, it's so important for us to recognize and remember that it wasn't the system or the university or the CSU that created the Educational Opportunity Program as an anti-racist space, but it was the students, it was the educators and allies demanding it and putting in the work, the protests, the lobbying. I mean, these warriors, they intentionally went to Sacramento to find the most conservative senator to champion the cause, and it was successful. And the work continues because it created this movement where Chico State was one of two campuses that agreed to do the pilot program. And I would have to say, I've seen some of the news reports from back in that time. I know Carol Robinson, before retired, worked with Stephanie Waldavini in the library to have some of our information archived. And seeing some of those papers back in the late 1960s, where it's like, hey, here's a program for colored kids and underserved kids. And for Chico State to be willing to do that and the Academic Senate to say, yes, we're going to do this at this time, I do think that was something to be applauded. But that was just one step. And I think as we continue in this work and continue to see what else can be done, the work does need to continue. And we do need to see more creation of these safe spaces where fundamentally we're just trying to help educate people of California. And that's what I love the colleagues that attended this presentation and the ones who emailed us saying that they weren't able to, and the fact that we're even having this conversation so that we can see what else can we do. Because if anything, this past year, good Lord, has showed us is that this work needs to continue and it's so important. So thank you everybody for coming in. Let's talk about it.
Teresita, did you want to share something?
Yes, thank you. And congratulations to EOP on decades of success and for your campus impact. I have a question for the EOP staff. In today's kind of Chico State planning, you know, we often hear conversations about what the university is doing to close the racial, the graduation gaps in our graduation initiative 2025. And in my opinion, I think, but I want to get your perspective, is that what's the missing piece of what we're doing right now and the work that we're trying to enact to close racial equity gaps? And to me, I think it's the disconnect that some of the decision makers have with respect to our students of color. And just want to get your perspective. And I think it speaks to Alvina's pyramid model about where we need to start. And I think that's why EOP has been so successful, is that you will really get the student, right? And not only do you get the student, you look like the student. You've experienced the same experience as a student. And so I know I'm asking a few different things and offering a few different perspectives, but in my work, I advocate that what the spaces that we have, such as EOP and the like, need to have people who look like the students and who have beyond empathy, who have shared the experiences of our students and how important that is and impactful it is in the work that we are trying to engage in. And so, and I know we've tried a few different things under the GI, but what are your perspective and how important it is that your staff is diverse and that and the impact that has, and the fact that you really know the student and the challenges and the pluses and the minuses of what they're facing to really foster inclusive student success on campus. And I know that was a long question comment, but I appreciate your feedback.
Well, I'll start, and I definitely agree with that Asita. Representation matters. We've been hearing that all over the place, even in TV commercials. But when we look at things like how EOP looks, the physical makeup, and then we also can look at some of our partners that we've worked with very closely. We can look at financial aid, right? And their representation of individuals who speak more than one language. We can look at the advising office and just the physical makeup and how, when I started, that office looked one way, and several years down the line, it's a variety of cultures and languages. And as difficult as it may be for us to do that here at Chico, and again, to get the results, it's not easy and it does take work, but we can't ever rest on that work, which is why I think Alvina's piece to this presentation was so critical, as well as knowing the history, knowing what we're currently doing with our first time freshmen and how we're creating such a culture to help them succeed. But also, like, we can't just sit back and rest, like, okay, EOP, they mark all the boxes. They got a Black woman, they have two Hmong, they have Latinos, they have, you know, they have a white person or two or three, and we're good to go. No, we have to continue to work and continue to say, okay, what other languages do we need to make sure that our professionals are, if not our professionals, our students have to be able to relate to students to, again, continue this work. So I think having the conversations and never being able to sit back and rest, even though we think of ourselves as a diverse place or an anti-racist space, that the work has to continue. And I can tell you, it gets tiring when we look at what we have to do at work, what's going on in the world, political stuff, oh Lord, Rona going on. I mean, it gets tiring, but we take a breath and then we get back to work because it's important. And I think for a lot of us, the alternative is something that we don't want. It's something we don't want for ourselves, our students, our families, for my future. That's not what I want, an alternative where people are tired of fighting and we just let it be. So yes, I think representation and not having to work and having those conversations. And I think Kendi's point, and I'm not sure if I agree with everything he said in the book, which is okay, that we don't stay in the anti-racist or racist state, that there's sort of like spaces that we move in between. And I'm like, okay, we could do that, but we have to have those conversations. And as we know, when some people hear the word racist, or when we use the word you're a racist as a insult to try and shut someone down, we have to have those conversations. And that's the difficult part. And hopefully we'll continue to have those conversations. We'll start having those conversations to get, again, in a place to where our educational system is doing what it's designed to do.
And I would like to add to that too. I think going back to my point about the perceptions, I think it takes like our program alone can't be the only one to buy into that, right? I think other departments, and it should be across the campus, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of research that says that students who they feel valued in pockets on campus, right? It's hard for them to feel like they belong on campus and that they feel like they have a say in campus if they're only doing that, feeling that way in pockets, right? Because it's not it doesn't go across the campus. And so I would say that I think something that we all can do better is to all kind of buy in into doing anti-racist work and doing all of that internal work.
So I have a question. I don't know if I'm gonna phrase it properly. Having the honor to work on campus, I see that our student affairs population, for the most part, is really gung-ho behind this work because it is important and we want to support our students. But how do we bring those to the table who might fear these conversations and might resist? Like, what are some suggestions or, I don't know, just thoughts about that? If that,
yes, that makes sense. It does. You know, Kelsey, and that's such a good point. Currently, I'm part of a middle leadership academy where I'm working with Kiara and a couple others on campus, and they're working with faculty learning communities and looking at equity gaps. And that's the same question. How do we bring people to the table to discuss this when it's like you're taking a look at yourself that maybe you're not ready to share with everybody else? And I think as hard as it may be, we just have to start. And maybe it's something where we can bring one person with us or have those conversations. But, you know, it is difficult because I know I'm good for, especially I think the age of Facebook and politics, I'm like, I'm not changing anybody's mind, right? But not necessarily change someone's mind, or sometimes I even struggle, do I want a person to understand or do I want them to be able to hear an opposing view or something that is a little bit different than their thoughts of what are what they've grown up with or what they've come to believe. And so sometimes it's just breaking down that piece by piece. I mean, I think to be able to do that. And then maybe it's also creating some type of programs to reach people. Is it a dialogue? Is it something larger? I mean, you're poised in a situation to where you're going into the high schools and working with students. And that's a great way to start as well, because when we talk about our future and, you know, starting with young students and especially young students who've grown up in Northern California and being able to help them look at a bigger world picture. And again, there's a lot of diversity in some of our Northern area schools, but sometimes there isn't. And to be able to help our young adults and students get prepared for that type of work and that type of the different types of things that they'll face in college, those are some of the things that you can do. Now, when it comes to colleagues and at the university, we all got to work together because I'm not sure. But great question, great input. And I'm talking a lot. Someone else.
Thank you.
Well, just to elaborate so that I get a little screen time as well. It's invitation only, unfortunately. And hopefully we have buy-in from all over the campus, from students to faculty, staff, to administrators. That's the only way that it works. That's the only way that we were able to build this. So in terms of holding that space, building it, fostering it as best as we can. I think that's the best efforts, whether that's, you know, us in our office and in our departments, just doing that individually and then collectively, we'll see, you know, the Wildcat community for what it is in terms of upholding and holding these anti-racist spaces and uplifting one another. So
any other questions or thoughts people would like to share before we Teresa takes us home?
I was just thinking about when Alvina was talking about empathy, it was reminding me of the day after the election when Trump was elected and the students crying in our building. And I was feeling exactly the same way. And I wasn't sure how to help them. I wasn't sure, you know, what could I do to comfort them, because I was feeling as scared as they were, honestly. And so now I'm feeling like, well, maybe that was okay just to say, I'm feeling the same way, but, you know, we're going to make it through. But I'm just, you know, wondering if anyone has any like advice, like how do you help without overstepping, or I don't know. I'm open to anything.
Yeah, what you shared, just sort of letting people know, because there's enough research and information about validation in general, and validation goes a long way for supporting people, because I learned early on, thankfully I had enough people around me when I started working in EOP. I knew nothing about EOP. I knew nothing about first generation students per se at the time. And I had some good colleagues and some students that really helped me learn, like, hey, you don't need to help us all the time. Just listen to us and then help us, you know, by validating us and making us know that we're being heard, that someone is there in case they want to come and ask for help or support, then they know you're there. And sometimes that's enough for a lot of people, because one thing that stands out in different research and information from first generation students, asking for help is one of the more difficult things for a lot of first gen students to do, because they may not be used to doing it. They may not be comfortable doing it because now they're in a setting that they're the first person, you know, to be in. So there's different variables, but just letting people know you're there for them quite often is enough. And it may be 3, 4, 5, 8 months until that person reaches out, but the whole time they knew in the back of their mind you were there as someone they could come to if they needed to.
Right. And if I can add to that, Ms. Sharon, definitely don't underestimate the work that you do. And just because a student may not know, or you may not be able to articulate the words, we know all that you do for EOP and our first time freshmen and other students. I mean, and that when we talk about the collaborations and how we get rid of barriers, the fact that we can send you an email and make a phone call to you when any of our students are having issues, your work in doing that is just as important as being able to console a student or myself after the election. So definitely look at everything that you'll be able to do. And I think that's how we're able to take those steps, that there's the work that's done behind the scenes. And unfortunately, that doesn't always get the credit that it deserves. And then the stuff that you do in person, which again, makes us feel good if you're able to console or just give me a hug because you know it's a bad day and the world sucks right now. And those are the important things. And we don't always share that information with people, but just want you to know what you're doing that we can see and what you're doing that not everybody can see is just important. And we do appreciate you.
I just wanted to add to that really quick too. In addition with validating our students and affirming our students, I think just being authentic, it goes pretty far. Being authentic and just saying, hey, I don't know what to say to make you feel better. And I get what you're saying, and that sounds really tough, you know, but I don't know what to say to make you feel better. I think that goes really far because I think what Josh said, I think our students understand that we can't fix all of their problems too. And they just kind of need someone to listen to them and tell them that what you're feeling is valid. And sometimes just asking is there something that you're looking for that maybe I can, you know, refer you to someone else because I don't think I can give that to you. Just being authentic and genuine, I think it goes pretty far with our students too.
Right. And if I can add one more thing, when we're back in person, I don't know, baked goods to the office, to some of us, especially if you're a good baker, that always wins. So cookies, anything, any of those wonderful things that you make, Sharon, that helps.
Yeah. And so I have another question that came in. What does the next 10 or 20 years look like to Chico State's EOP? Would EOP like to scale up, have new initiatives? What's on the EOP wish list?
Okay, I will start. And please, everybody, like I said, I've been talking. I would love for us to have more students, more staff and more students, not more students first, because we have to serve them. But, you know, right now we have restrictions because of the program. So for EOP, we are only able to admit students who meet the criteria of being first generation college and historically low income. And I would love to be able to do maybe either or those criteria, because what we're seeing that students who have parents that maybe have a bachelor's degree, but maybe have grown up in underrepresented neighborhoods and environment, or not have gone to the schools that have all the best accommodations and offerings to classes, that sometimes, even though the fact that their parent received a degree, they still need that help. But due to the large number of applications, and for those of you that don't know, we do limit our EOP class because we have only a set number or set dollar amount for EOP grant that we give students that has not been enlarged in years, years, and years. we only have a certain amount of physical space. We only have a certain amount of staff and student staff that can serve these students. So it would be a disadvantage if we admitted like 250, 300 students to our program without having the resources. So I would love to where we can have more resources so that we can say, okay, let's consider you that even if you're over income, but if you need these services and this help, we can do that. So increasing it more. And again, not so that EOP is for every single first-time freshman, although I think they could all use it, but so that we can increase more students. That's what I would like, to be able to serve more students. I would like for us to be able to focus more on students who are doing well academically and not just students who are struggling. And that's been a charge that we've been trying to do ever since I've been working for EOP. But I would say those are the two biggest things that I would like to see for the future of EOP. But I think when it comes to reality, we don't know what the budget issues that we're facing, what that's going to look like. And we know that we want to try to continue to do our best and provide access to the students who are in the most need. And right now we do have to focus on that population that applies to us that meet the criteria of low income and first generation college students. That was a great question, by the way. Who else wants to add to that?
I just want to echo the sentiments Cecilia put in the chat. One of the things I thought about is, and it all comes back down to funding, right? Is being able to have, for EOP to receive enough funding to kind of to compensate that financially with our EOP grant to students that can match up with how expensive things are getting and how everything changes from one year to the next and everything just keeps rising and increasing. And we haven't been able to do the same with our EOP grants for our students. So that to change would be amazing. And also to have the funding or particular the ability to send our students. I think one thing I really would like to see within EOP is for our student, for us to be able to give them the opportunity to be a part of these large conferences and get exposed to things like that. And to be able to, you know, give them maybe a separate grant or fellowship to go to something that happens once a year, whether it's for their major or whether it's for professional development or just something like that. Just give them that type of exposure within their first, second, third year in EOP, just so, you know, they don't have to wait for later for other opportunities or expose them early to things like that and give them the opportunity for growth within themselves. So that's something that I would love to be able to do for our students as well.
You know, I think if there's like a catalog of what I can pick out and choose for EOP and what I see EOP 10 years, I mean, I would say priority registration, more EOP grant. I mean, there's so many things, you know, they don't have to pay for graduation. There's so many things that I could choose, but I think the EOP grant, I think a lot of our students definitely, that's like the biggest resource that our students really take away and they really depend on us and count on us for that. So I would say having changes increase in our EOP grant would go far.
All right. So thank you so much for everyone tuning in. It looks like it's just about that time. In the chat, I did put in the website where you will be able to see our recording. It's the First Gen, one of many podcast website. And so as well, it should be sent out in the announcement. So and a link in there so you have access to that as well. But thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Amazing conversation. I hope to be able to continue these questions in this type of conversation in person. And if not, virtually, of course. Thank you all for coming. And I hope you all have a good rest of your afternoon.
Thank you, host. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're all amazing. Great job. Proud EOP alum.
Thank you. And everyone, remember, there'll be more book and comment events. So check those announcements in. Let's keep it going. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.